It's 12 Enough, Season 9, Episode 10A, with your host, Jonathan Malone, and guest host, Cheryl Harris. Twelve Enough is a podcast about Christian faith and culture in the modern age. Your host, Jonathan Malone, is the pastor of the First Baptist Church in East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Cheryl Harris is the pastor of the First Baptist Church of Attleboro, Massachusetts. This podcast is brought to you by William Shakespeare. Since 1974, William Shakespeare has been providing excellent furniture repair for everyone in the greater tri-state area. Find him at 373 Main Street or at 443-556-8711. William Shakespeare, fixing your chairs, couches, and love seats at a low and reliable price. And we're back. William Shakespeare. Thanks, Billy. Billy Shakespeare. Billy Shakes. Bill. That was just a great sponsor. When I got the call from Billy Boy Shakespeare, I saw it on my caller ID, William Shakespeare, and I thought, this is amazing, and I can't say no to someone of such esteem and renown. Wow. Anyway, we're now going to hear the deep conversation I had with Cheryl Harris. It was really good. I almost said it like I didn't really believe it, but no, it really was good. We talked about one book. We talked about Black Boy by Richard Wright, and it was such a fun experience to really just delve into one piece of literature. Maybe I'll do this with music, with someone else, or with poetry. Who knows? I mean, this might be a whole brave new world of 12 Enough listening that we may enter into. Or this may be a once-off thing. I mean, talking with Cheryl about literature is just a real treat. She has such a great knowledge of it, such a great training, and just brings so much energy, so many great gifts. And it was a really good experience. Now, if you have not read Black Boy, you should be okay. You should be all right. You should be able to keep up and track along with the conversation. But if not, I'll wait right now for you to go and get the book or download it and read it, and then we'll start the conversation. Okay, I'll wait. When you're ready, just put your books down and raise your hands, and that way I'll know you're ready for me to continue with this conversation. Okay, just go ahead. Okay, is everyone? Oh wait, no. Okay, wait one more minute. All right, now, no, not yet? Okay, well, now can I, you have to go to the bathroom? All right, you know what, forget it, read it on your own time. Here it is, the conversation I had with Cheryl Harris. So this episode is going to be posted. This part will be posted after they've already heard the Rylage and stuff. But we want to mention for those folks, so go back, listen to the Rylage again, and especially the idea of busy taking care of yourself. Read Heschel's book, Abraham Joshua or Joseph Heschel?
Joshua.
Joshua Heschel's book, Sabbath. It's just brilliant. It's a work of art.
It is a work of art. It will help you think more about what it means to rest and to do it in the midst of a busy life.
Yeah. So, but that's not what we're talking about today. This is, so I'm excited for this one because this is the first episode where we're focusing on a book. And some of it's like a deep reads, which I'm not, that's not mine. I can't take it. Other people have used that term, so I am not claiming it or anything. On Facebook, I'll tell people, you know, read this book ahead of time.
Yes, good.
To help. But the book that is starting the conversation, and we'll see where it goes, is Black Boy by Richard Wright. Now, Cheryl can see the copy I have in front of me. I picked this up used somewhere. I don't know how I ended, you know, you end up with books on your shelf somehow.
Sure.
And we have a book group at our church, and this is the book they chose. So I read it, and I didn't know the one that I have, I'm trying to see when this one was published, I think in the 40s. Yeah, so this one was published 45 and then 66.
Yeah.
And I say that because there's two versions. There's two editions. So this one ends at a certain moment.
Mm-hmm.
The second edition, the one that's probably published after 66, has a second part of his life.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
So here's the spoiler part. So I didn't either. And I'm reading this and I'm reading along. I'm like, oh, this is really great. And I was talking to someone else in the book group. He says, yeah, it got tough in the second part. And I'm like, I don't know. It seemed pretty easy.
Second part?
Yeah. So this one ends with Richard Wright. So for those who haven't read it, it's...
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, a lot of spoilers. I don't care about spoilers. Would you describe it as an autobiography or memoir or somewhere in there?
Yeah, I think it's in between. It's almost... it's historical.
Yeah.
It's biographical, and it is memoir.
Yeah,
right? Yeah.
And that's part of what makes it so good.
I think
I have problems with memoir as a genre.
Mm-hmm.
I find it self-grandizing.
Yeah.
And often petty. Mm-hmm. But this is not at all.
Yeah.
And an autobiography often feels like I did this, and then I did this, and then
right.
I did this.
No,
and that's not this either.
No, it's got a nice flow to it, and it's. The storytelling is so, it's such a high quality.
Yeah,
yeah,
really
so.
Is. And so I think, so in all that to being said, the version I read, he recounts his life growing up in Mississippi and then moving different places to Nashville. And then he's moving to Chicago. That was his big goal. How can I get to Chicago? And that's where this edition ends.
Ah.
And from what I understand, when he goes to Chicago, then he gets involved with a workers' movement,
mm-hmm.
Gets involved with communism or Marxism, and so I didn't read that part.
No, I did not either.
Okay, and that was one of the things I've wondered is, in the book group, is the book stronger without that second part? Or not. Since neither of us have read that part, we can't speak to that.
Right.
And that would be an interesting thing to read one and to say, because some stories are better ending at a different place.
Yeah, there's something about reading these types of books that I appreciate being left with my imagination.
Yeah.
And not having it finished so neatly. I think we really are in a society that wants neat completions.
Yeah.
You know, we want things to end. We want to know all the rest of it and what happened. And maybe that wasn't so important. What was important was how he grew up, what he encountered, and what he overcame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In Chicago was this hope for him.
Mm-hmm.
It represented a lot for him. It represented, you know, first the North.
Right.
But also a place of, it felt like a place of real promise, of possibility. And to even... to finally make that decision to go. That was the big, one of those big conflicts for him that I saw in this book of how am I going to overcome this need to stay here, this pull to stay in the South. And you know, a lot of people said, you don't want to go up North, people are crazy up there.
Yeah. And his early ventures into the North as a child were so wrought with poverty and shaming and fear and hunger. So his desire to get back to the city, he knew that he would also encounter some unpleasant experiences. That wasn't this sort of promised land that he may have thought of as a child. So.
And that's almost, so the second part is almost, mm-hmm. it's like a Paradise Lost.
Yeah. Sure, Miltonian for sure.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that. And there is something about saying, don't spoil it for me.
Mm.
Let's just stay with your conflict of how do you get out.
Exactly.
How do you get, and and maybe make it 2 books. And again, neither of us have read it, so
no, that's right.
We really, so listeners, dear listeners,
we'll go back and read it.
Yeah.
We'll do another podcast.
Yeah, we'll do another.
Sorry.
So for those of you who are, you know, scholars out there who have read Black Boy and have read the fuller version of it, we aren't speaking to that. We are speaking to the 45 or the 66 edition.
Yeah.
That does not have that part in there. And I don't think I can recommend one version of it. Well, because we haven't read the other, we can't recommend it. But I mean, this book, I felt it's a strong book on its own. I mean, I didn't feel like it was incomplete.
Not at all. Richard Wright is just masterful with the turn of phrase.
Oh,
and so I think that you're pulled in a way that allows you to keep reading, and it doesn't feel unsatisfying when you get to the end of it. And I'm sure that the second edition just adds more richness to what's already there.
And one of the things I really appreciate about his writing, and I thought was we could kind of first talk about the broader aspect of what we really love about his stuff, and then I have some ideas that we can get a little deeper, but the poetic, there were moments when he went into more poetry than prose.
Ah, that's interesting.
Yeah, and there are moments
yeah.
when the prose is really strong, and you're following a narrative, and you're seeing where the story's going, but in those moments, it's when he said, let me try to give you a different way of experiencing what it was like for me. Let me try to explain the smells for you.
Yeah.
Or you were talking about the blackberries.
Yeah, when he ate the blackberries and he said that he had finished them, but the stain of the berries was still on his lips and the taste still in his mouth. Just wonderful.
And I think that those are those moments when you're saying this is no longer just a memoir. And it's no longer just an autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a story, this is a book that's trying to get us to this place of understanding what it might have been like to live back then within the minutiae. And not just like, let's talk about the struggles and the relationships, we get into that, but what was it like, you know, just to eat blackberries? What was it like to take a moment to pause and to smell or to listen? That's brilliant.
It's brilliant, and it's not just about the taste and the smells, right?
Yeah.
It's about the fact that this person had been starving, and now they get to taste something. And the taste buds are even more enlightened by this taste because it's rare. So what does it feel like to eat your fill after you've been starving and having so meager?
Right.
Portions available to you.
And something like blackberries.
Yeah.
Which we're spoiled. Because we can go to Trader Joe's.
That's right.
Any time of the year. And buy blackberries. And I love blackberries. I think they're delicious. But to be in that place of, like you said, of starvation, and then to eat something that bursts when you bite into it.
That's exactly right.
There's such a tactile aspect to eating blackberries, as seeds get caught in your teeth, and the stains are on your fingers, your lip. I mean, what a food to choose to talk about.
That's exactly. You taste it. It's visual. I found the sentence, and he has
a lot of
sentences with no punctuation, which makes for good writing.
Yeah.
May not pass an English test, but. So that sentence is, there was the dry, hot summer morning when I scratched my bare arms on briars while picking blackberries and came home with my fingers and lips stained black with sweet berry juice. Sweet berry juice. You can almost taste the juice as you eat that.
And it's such a... You know, it's such a childhood thing.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, and that's one of those moments where I would say, you know, the title kind of gives away what the story's about.
Yeah.
You know, growing up African-American, growing up black in Mississippi, and moving, and that conflict, that tension. But then to say that's not all, you know, his ethnicity, you know, the color of his skin is not the totality of who he is.
That's exactly right, Jonathan. It's not just about... the black boy, but it's about the human person. And that he brings such humanity throughout the book, when he's questioning his mom about what is the difference between white and black, and is Granny white, and what color is Dad, and
right.
You know, he has all these questions that are not welcomed
right.
by his mom, and we can imagine why.
Yeah.
So we get this social commentary interweaved throughout the book in a way that makes it accessible and gives, for those who may not be black, a view of what life was like.
Yeah, yeah, and you get this, it's interesting, I had an empathy for the mother, as much as a horror.
Yeah,
you know, I mean,
good Lord.
Right, because yeah, the way she would beat him, and you know, I don't think I went to a place of judging.
Yeah, good for you.
And I think he portrayed her really well. I mean, and a lesser writer would have made her very two-dimensional.
That's exactly right.
And would have made her into a villain of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then maybe in the end said, like, but I knew that she meant well.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
You know, and like, let me look her up then after the way she beat the crap out of me again and again.
Yeah.
I knew she meant well.
Yeah.
But, and, I mean, he's a brilliant, brilliant writer. To bring, mm-hmm. even to bring me to this place of saying, boy, she the frustration, anger, the helplessness that she felt that led to this kind of, this visceral reaction when he would ask these really good and honest and childlike questions.
That's right.
And just say, you know, and just to react in such a violent way, boy, what she must be carrying. But then at the same time, I say, why can't you just talk to him?
Right.
Why can't you just sit down like, all right, let's talk about this. Let's get into this. Why do you have to hit him? And, you know, and I felt torn. And boy, that's great. I think that's, I don't know if that's what he wanted.
Yeah.
But I think that's a great place to bring the reader.
Oh, I think so. He really portrays the despair and the helplessness of the mother.
Yeah.
And her only outlet being, I have to beat you because I need to keep you contained. Because if you try to act forthright and powerful in this society, black boy, then you will be killed. I remember as a young girl and as a grown-up black in this country, I could remember hearing conversations with some of the adults in our circles, and essentially what they said was, we have to beat the kids, because if we don't, they'll get out there and someone will kill them.
Yeah.
So that is the challenge. Yeah. Not that I agree with, I mean, the merciless beatings that he took.
Oh, yeah.
If that didn't break your spirit, it's amazing that he was able to come up from that.
Well, and later on, in his journeys after he left, in one of the groups, he met this another black young man who would play the fool.
Yeah, that's right.
For the white folks. And did it on purpose, partially just to make some money, but partially just this way I know I won't get beat.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I often think about Shakespearean fool when I see these fools in these books, which we see often in these kinds of novels. And they're the wisest ones in the story.
Right.
They're the ones with the most ability to navigate relationships. And yet, they do it through the lens of a fool.
And I think what Richard Wright is doing, when he even portrays that and his view of that, he's saying, do we have to settle? Like this person who's decided, all right, I'm going to play the fool because this way I can flourish within my station. And Richard Wright is saying, but do you need to accept your station?
Yeah, he's raising the questions, and you cannot help but see the backdrop of the time in which he's writing.
Yeah.
And the strange fruit that Billie Holiday talked about. The lynchings that happened in that society.
Yeah.
And the people who were beaten. And Richard Wright is so crafty with how he weaves in this image of slavery.
Yep.
When he asks about his grandmother, well, who named her? Well, who did that? Oh, she was owned by a slave. So she was a slave. So you just start to hear behind that why the fool's behavior is a way through. And also his challenge, you know, that young activist kind of challenge that says, no, we don't want to take this anymore.
Right. And then constantly being told, if you keep this up, you're going to end up in trouble.
You're
going to end up dead.
Oh, my gosh. He got that warning many, many times.
And he was a troublesome child. He was someone who just...
Someone that both of us could probably relate to.
Right, there were times reading this, like, Richard, just don't speak. Just don't say anything. Just
that's
please,
right.
Just let it go. Just
just be quiet. But he couldn't. I love the curiosity that he really presented himself as this precocious curious, intelligent child.
Yeah, and I don't think he was playing himself up. I mean, again, if you read this book, his brilliance just shines through. And he's not, and it's not a bragging kind of brilliance. It's, I mean, you read some writers and you say, you're a narcissist, and that's clear. Others, they're just so good that they, just by writing, you see how amazingly brilliant they are. And Richard Wright is, yeah, I mean, this book is just, it blew me over.
Well, yeah, and you think about the fact that he struggled to get a formal education.
Yeah.
He wasn't in school. Yeah, and he, when he did try to avail himself of reading, he was often chastised or beaten.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want him to read things, his grandmother called it, the devil's work or evil.
Yep, yeah, so the religious aspect too, and boy, that kind of frustrated me, because, you know, churches, boy, churches.
We love churches.
Yeah, we really do. But churches, you know, churches have the potential and have been at times places of liberation for people who are oppressed. Places where women have found their voice. Places where African-American communities have found, you know, education and ways in which they can come into their own. And at the same time, they've been places of real oppression.
Serious oppression,
and,
yes.
Yes, serious oppression. So I say that, and it's also places where women's voices have been taken away.
Yes.
Where African-Americans have been pushed down. And here we see, even within the community, say, don't be reading this stuff.
That's right.
It's not, boy, churches, come on.
Yeah.
You can do so well.
We can do so well. Well, you know, I say we love churches, which means that I feel like we have the right to also challenge and to rail against some of the things that happen in churches. And we would be remiss if we didn't say churches have oftentimes held the mantle of oppression for groups. And that is not something we're proud of. We don't want that to be the case, but it has been.
It has happened. It's been self-inflicted and it's been imposed.
That's exactly right.
And so, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So, but that gets to the reading thing, the place where, for me, I mean, there were so many aha moments in this book.
Yes.
You know, moments where I said, wow, that was, but the big one for me that really jumped out was when he read H.L. Mencken. And for those who don't know who H.L. Mencken is, a provocateur, in really the most brilliant sense. I think probably one of my favorite fictional depictions of him is in the play. I forgot the author of the play, but Inherit the Wind.
Yeah.
I don't remember who wrote it, but listeners, go look it up. Inherit the Wind, the wonderful play about the Scopes trial in Dayton, Tennessee. And H.L. Mencken has this brilliant role in it as the voice of skepticism. Who's the who's the dancer? Who's an American in Paris.
Oh.
You know who I'm thinking about?
Yes, I do. Of course it won't come to
Gene
me.
Gene Kelly.
Okay, thank you.
So in the classic movie version of Inherit the Wind, Gene Kelly plays H.L. Mencken. Gene Kelly gets to play a crusty skeptic, which usually Gene Kelly plays the happy, dancing, go-lucky kind of person. And boy, he's great as a crusty skeptic. But, so H.L. Mencken, you know, wrote for the Baltimore Sun, I think, for many, many years. Mm-hmm. You know, a journalist, but really...
Satirist, essayist.
Mm-hmm. So Richard Wright reads about Mencken, reads this, someone lambasting him in another book or article, and says, I want to read this guy.
Yeah.
And it was this, in reading Mencken, he writes about how it was this revelation.
Yeah.
How this whole world, because there's a sense of like, I don't understand white folks. I don't understand white people. I just don't trust them. They don't, and all the interactions with white people he had were very negative. So you can understand, like, I get why you would be this place. And then he reads Mencken, and then he says, and from there he went to Chekhov, he went to Tolstoy. I mean, he just started reading all these other people. And it was this moment of like, holy cow. There's so much more nuance and complexity than what I've been aware of, and it was books that was that avenue.
And that's what I think good literature does. It opens up not just a world to you, but perspectives that sometimes, and I think this was the case with Richard Wright, a perspective that he had but he hadn't found linkages for his perspective in the world in which he was. But when he began to read the satirists and Tolstoy and other writers who also had a critical eye on society, I think he found his literary family. And that was eye-opening and groundbreaking for him.
I love that, that this perspective that he had, but wasn't, you know, in the sense of like, I need someone else to say yes.
Yeah, that's right. That's, that goes with what you're thinking. I think the same thing. It's like when we look at a group picture and we find not just our photo, but other people who look like us. We say, oh, I'm among other thinkers like
I'm
this.
I'm not alone.
That's right.
That, you know, and that's a perspective I didn't have. I didn't, so I really like that gave a sense of credential to his own voice, but gave said yes.
Yeah, I think I'm probably doing too much identifying of myself and transferring of my own thinking and my life to Richard Wright. But I remember when I would read Little Women or read Tom Sawyer, or, you know, we begin to read those books and you start to say, oh, this is the world I see. I see through this similar lens. Oh, I have the same challenge. My voice may not be respected or heard, or the way I think is not so common. And then you find out, well, yeah, it's quite common.
So now that's, and that is, I love it. Because when I read that part, and I think I'm projecting, you know, I read it as saying, oh, there's a whole other world out there and I'm learning about it. But maybe the reason I had that reading of it is because here I am, a white person, reading Black Boy.
Right.
You know, so a story about a black man growing up. And so I'm, so for me, it's like, all right, share more of this world with me.
Yeah.
Tell me more about this
that's
world.
Right.
Tell, you know, experiences that I just never have.
More of an observer.
Yeah, I am an observer, but you're bringing me in such an intimate way. And so I project my experience onto Richard Wright when he's reading.
Yes, yes,
Lightbulb.
Yes.
So, but I love the greater nuance you're bringing.
Well, I think it's just, this is the value of us having these conversations and coming together. So as a black person reading the story, I project to and put myself into it and see it differently. And I think that's the beauty of literature.
Yeah, yeah, to say it's okay.
Yeah.
Neither of us are
both
wrong.
Both are good at sex.
For the English teachers out there that say this is the correct reading of the book, we're past that.
Yeah, exactly. We're past that. We're now saying this is how we see it, and this is what it evokes in us. I love that we sort of cascaded this conversation, Jonathan, from the evoking of taste to now this evoking of taste in literature.
You know,
like, how do I read a book, and what do I see in a book, and what do other authors bring to a book? What does the reader bring?
So I just thought that there's a question of risk involved.
Yeah, say more about that.
So I think on two levels. One, the author needs to take a risk.
Yeah.
And that might be part of, I continue to go on this trope against memoirs. And so the listeners are probably rolling their eyes. Here he goes again. Yeah. But for me, in the memoirs that I don't like don't take real risks.
Uh-huh.
They stay surface. Here's where I struggled, here's how it got better, and here's how I, you know, there's always going to be some kind of conflict. Every good narrative has some kind of conflict, but the risk will go deeper. And I think Richard Wright's book takes a lot of risk.
Yeah.
And, you know, not just him saying, let me show you a little bit of the experience, but let me show you, let me get really into the nuance, let me share where my questions were, and let me show how I might have messed up, or let me, you know, really make myself vulnerable to you. And then, so there's risk there. And I think that's almost becomes like, of course you've got to take risks as authors. That becomes almost trite to say it, but those who do it are far and few between.
Mm-hmm.
You know, take that real deep risk. But then the reader needs to take a risk. Like, I could read this and keep an armchair's distance to it and just say, clearly this is about growing up in the South as a black boy in 1940s, and it gives us a good introduction to that socioeconomic experience, and isn't that interesting, right? And that would be a good book review. You know, we were talking earlier about how I try not to write reviews, I write reflections.
Right.
And I think in the reflection there's risk, because then it's saying, what am I bringing to this? How am I going to allow myself to be affected, to be changed, to be challenged? And I'll tell you, as a white person reading this book, the first time I brought it with me to a coffee shop, I felt a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah. Why?
Well, because it says black boy.
Exactly.
Right there.
Oh, we don't use that term anymore,
right?
Right,
right. Even that, you know. Like, and then I thought, like, well, it's a classic. Hopefully those who know it will read it. Like, oh, good book. Nicely done. Good for you. You're broadening your horizons. You know, then I hold it up with pride. But there is, you know, so even that, you know, like, boy, yeah, it's a phrase that we're not comfortable with anymore. I'm not comfortable with, because it's, you know, it's something I'm not supposed to say.
Yeah.
So am I going to take the risk of even reading this book?
Uh-huh.
You know, and that's not really that big of a risk.
No,
it shouldn't be.
But it is for many. You're saying several things that are generating so many thoughts in my mind. So the first one is taking the risk. And for Richard Wright, what did he have to lose?
Mm.
I mean, you talk about being at the bottom of a societal heap, right?
Yeah.
And so you put it all out there because, for goodness sake, not putting it out there, you don't gain anything. But I think you're right, Jonathan, that today, even today, writers need to be willing to bear themselves in order to get people to feel. Because if we can't feel it, then we're just at the head level, at the cognitive level, but nowhere else, not in the heart,
right?
And not in, maybe this makes us do something different. And I'm making a link and a leap from Richard Wright to how we read the Bible too, right?
Oh, yeah.
That we need to read it with our whole selves, head, heart, and hands. And this is, I think, this kind of writing, these writers, Richard Wright and colleagues, do that for us. I think about James Baldwin, who's probably somewhat of a contemporary of Richard Wright, who did that too, just put his whole self out there.
Right.
And then you say, I can relate to that on a human level, even if I can't relate to that as a black person or a female or, I can relate to being terrified, having parents who were doing the best they could trying to protect you, not having enough resources to do all that they could do, and then being terrified that you would grow beyond them, and then they wouldn't know what to do with you.
Oh, wow, that's great. And at the same, so I like that, being terrified that I may grow beyond them.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, what a theme right there.
Oh, my gosh.
That one's really good. I want to sit with that. but then also, I you know, knowing that, and at the same time, while I can relate, I also know those places where I can't relate, and he is still inviting me in.
And still, that's what good literature does, right?
Yeah.
It says, come on. Yeah. I know you may not have lived this, but take a look.
Yeah. And still, other books that come to mind are like Grapes of Wrath.
Yeah.
Which is, I'm never going to know what it's like to be an Okie during the Dust Bowl.
Not at all.
But he still brings you in. Or more recent, Night by Elie Wiesel. Passed away not that long ago.
Not that long ago, but what an incredible account of what it was like to be in a Holocaust survivor.
And I think what all of these people do, Richard Wright included, is because there's also that risk of overdoing it.
Yeah.
Of
melodramatic.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then, that's when it gets to a place where the reader says, I can't.
Well, it's not true. It's not credible.
Right. Yeah. So to be able, and that's where genius, I think, comes in, to be able to bring you in to have you experienced it, but there's also to do it in a way where it's true, where it's credible, where it's deep, but it's not gushing.
That's so true. It makes me think about Hemingway and the way he wrote, and this brings you in when you think about bullfighting. Like, I would never, ever go to a bullfight, but the way he would describe it, it would make you feel like you're sitting right there in the stands. So, I think that's it, but it wasn't too melodramatic, it wasn't too far.
Right.
I don't know how you find that tension place.
That's why I use that word genius, and I don't use that, I don't throw it out there.
No, I hear you.
But you and I mean, those books are there, that we read those, and we say, even if we wouldn't say the person's a genius, there is genius in that writing.
Right, that's right.
Yeah, and those are, and I think that, there are so many books that either come close or really don't come close at all. And you read those, you're like, oh.
Yeah, no, it's true.
Why did you write this?
When you read Black Boy or Native Son, another one of Richard Wright's books, you know that you are in company with this genius level.
Yeah.
And it is wonderful. It makes it hard that you understand why this is a classic.
Yeah. That's part of what makes classics. They transcend time in that way. I think a comparison might be, so this I'm going to take a little chance here. And I read a little bit ago, The Color of Water.
Yeah.
By James.
I don't think I've read that.
I don't remember his last name. He's still alive. That one is a memoir.
Yeah.
And he's lifting up his mother and also talking about his own life. And I don't think it's as good. We're kind of getting at this ephemeral place. There was something about, there were moments when I wish he went deeper with his own decisions and choices and such, and he didn't.
James McBride.
Now I'm gonna flatter him with another book. So I'm not
trashing
him as an author. I'm just saying that because I think he's a great author. That book. There are moments when he made these decisions or it's a change in his life, and it felt like he just kind of glossed over it. And I was like, I wish you went. And there were moments when he talked about his mother that really elevated her.
Yeah.
Now he tried. I felt like there was still this struggle to give a real picture of her, but she was still on this pedestal throughout the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I couldn't relate.
Not as honest.
Right. And it was like, what could you do? How could you? It wasn't the same. Now his book, Good Lord Bird, it's brilliant.
Yeah, good.
And that was about John Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in that, he did something where it really does bring the reader into this understanding of who John Brown might have been or what that time was like or something going. So I think James McBride is a great author.
Yeah.
I want to use that book because that's a book that a lot of people lift up. And this is The Color of Water.
Right.
And it's a fine book. And I'd recommend it to people to read it. But I think it I don't want to say pales in comparison, but it doesn't come to the same place that Black Boy does.
And I wonder if McBride's book, Color of Water, was written in 1995, I think, or something.
Yeah,
that sounds
about right.
Yeah, and Richard Wright's 1945.
Yeah.
I think we've lost some nuance during the decades. I think nuance makes the difference. There's a more contemporary writer. His name is Nathan McCall. I don't know if he's written more than one book, but the book he wrote, it's called Makes Me Wanna Holler.
Okay.
That's the name of his book. And it is raw. And it is about his life in Virginia, growing up poor, similar to a Richard Wright experience. But he pulls you in with the rawness. It doesn't have the nuance, but it has this emotional pull that you almost can't ungrip yourself from.
Is it almost too much?
It's right in that line of tension.
Okay,
exactly.
Yeah,
so it's the kind of thing you're talking about where the risk is taken, but it's not exploited. And so I wonder if McBride is almost too...
I feel like he holds back. In that book, he doesn't take the risk.
Yeah.
I don't mean to disparage him at all. Other books are just.
Yeah.
But yeah, not every author. Every author is not going to write every book. Every book that an author writes is not going to be great.
I often wonder, as one who writes, and you're a writer as well, when we're writing sometimes, do we have the audience in mind, or are we writing for ourselves? And I think that changes how we communicate.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, because.
So that's a great, when Richard Wright wrote Black Boy, who do you think the author was that he had in mind?
I think that he really was expressing his life to white people.
So it was for a white audience?
I think it was for a white audience, because he takes his time describing, explaining, bringing in the element of what family was like in a way that would be very familiar to a black person, maybe wouldn't need so much explanation.
Okay, yeah.
But he gives a lot. And I think that his audience was, let me talk to you white people. I can't really talk to you directly.
Right, yeah. At the same time, based on your reaction to it earlier, that your projection of, here's someone else who gets it. When you read this, did you say, there was a sense of like, someone else, I get this, or...
Yeah, I have to say, when I read this, I'm reading it the second time now, I feel like, that's my boy, that's my family.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's my homeboy.
When
he talks about his grandmother and his mother and his father and the male figures, I know those people.
Okay.
So I feel like a companion.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So there is a sense of like, mm-hmm. you know, if let's say, you know, if someone's growing up in isolation.
Yeah.
To read this may say, okay, there's other people out there.
Yeah.
For you, it sounds like, you know, I don't get the sense if I grew up in isolation, but
no.
To read this, like, yes, I'm with you on this.
Yeah.
This
is, and we now say humble beginning. So I grew up in humble beginning.
Okay.
Yeah. We don't talk about poverty anymore. Nobody's poor, right? Everyone's humble.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I want someone to say, like, I grew up in audacious beginnings.
Exactly.
Oh,
exactly,
just loud beginnings. And no one grew up rich, just audacious.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think what the other thing Richard Wright does for me is that he creates language that builds a bridge between two societies, white and black. And
yeah.
That is powerful.
And that was my next, that kind of is the next question I was going to ask is, who would you recommend this, recommend read this book?
Yeah, well, you know, it's high schools, many high schools have it as required reading.
Good.
So, and which I think is fantastic.
Yeah.
But, you know, we talked earlier, Jonathan, about the church and how wonderful the church is and how flawed the church is.
Right.
And I would love for this to be on church reading lists. And wouldn't it be great
to make a required reading for churches?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think we I really think we need reading lists for churches because it's too easy for us to get into our nice little buildings and leave the world out.
Yeah.
And to do good things, really good things. That I'm not denigrating that anyway.
Right, right.
But not to identify in a risk-taking way with how others are living, whoever the others are.
Right. And so that might, so, I mean, I originally thought white churches, but why not black churches as
Why
well?
Not? Yeah, we need, because with black churches, what happens, I think, is people then get language to talk about their oppressed states.
Okay.
And for white people, I think what they get is an observer, a bird's eye view of what life might be but like if you're not in a privileged position.
It helps develop an empathy.
Yes, and that's key, right? That gets us to the head heart.
Yeah.
So then when we go back and we read these scriptures about Jesus helping those on the edges and the highways and the byways, we start to put faces there. And maybe they are black faces or women's faces or LGBTQ faces.
Right.
Or, you know, we start to put the faces there. And I think we can't lose sight of our empathy.
Yeah, and that's what good works do.
Yeah.
I think a really interesting book study would be, and if you ever, and this would be here, I'll have, you can do this. This is
thank you. I appreciate that.
Oftentimes there are these, you know, inter-ethnic dialogues. So, you know, black church, white church get together, talk about it. Wouldn't it be interesting if they both read this and Catcher in the Rye?
Oh. That would be very cool.
Because Catcher in the Rye, you have white privilege, still dealing with angst, still dealing with, you know, like, I don't know who I am. And there's just like, what's wrong with this kid? But, you know, I've got another well-written book.
Wow, Jonathan, that would be a great podcast to have both of our churches read these two books.
Yeah.
And then have a group conversation about it. I love the idea of the juxtaposition of Catcher in the Rye and Black Boy.
Yeah, they're so different.
So different, and different authors, different ways of coming up, different ways of seeing the world. Yeah, it would be helpful if I were the pastor of a predominantly black church, but that's not the case.
Right.
So we, but having the conversation and opening it up would be useful and helpful.
And then to even say, what would Richard Wright say to Holden Caulfield?
I love it. Well, you know, what you're suggesting, which I think is so cool, is to put the authors in conversation with one another.
Yeah.
You know, Richard Wright in Hemingway, or Richard Wright in Mencken, or...
Yeah. If Richard Wright ever got to meet H.R. Mencken, what would that... So, we're good. I think we're at a good spot. I think, folks, if you haven't read Black Boy yet, really,
it
needs to be on your list. I hate to be one of those people like, you must read this book, because I know that everyone has their own reading list and such, so
Then I'll say it. You must read this book.
Cheryl says you must read this book. We strongly recommend it.
Yeah, we do.
It's
good
yeah,
read.
Yeah, it really is a good read. I would, if you're thinking about age levels, I think high school and up.
High school and up for sure.
Yeah.
16 and above.
Yeah.
And I think when you read it with an eye for what can I learn from this, as opposed to, gee, I feel really terrible about what happened and I feel guilty. And I often find people bring that emotion of guilt or pity to the reading, and that's not helpful.
That's the difference between sympathy and empathy.
Yeah.
Sympathy is just, boy, I really feel really sorry for Richard Wright and for all black people. So that would be me being a sympathetic white person. Empathy would be, I'm now starting to get a sense of what it might be like. Now I'm starting to understand where this continued rage that we see in America is coming from.
That's right. And I think it also, empathy says, I may not be able to relate to what it's like to be a black boy,
right,
but I can relate to what it feels like to be an outsider.
Yeah, yeah. So, read Black Boy. We mentioned so many other books.
Yeah,
folks,
so many.
Read. Just read good books.
The more you read, the younger you'll feel.
That's right, yeah, there we go. Excellent. All right, good. Good conversation.
Always, Jonathan. Thank you.
Catcher in the Rye, Black Boy. I really do think that would be a fascinating book study, just a great experience. Please try it and let me know how it goes. Okay, I'm not going to do it. Well, maybe I will. I don't know. Anyway, that was a good conversation. I like I said, I enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed it as well. I hope you got something out of it. Maybe after having heard it, if you haven't read the book yet, you will go out and read Black Boy, and then read Catcher in the Rye, and then do an analysis of the two different characters, and then write some fan fiction. Write some fan fiction of those two characters meeting each other and what that would be like. And you can send in that fan fiction to 12enough@gmail.com. And in fact, you can send in any of your comments or questions or anything like that to 12enough@gmail.com. You can come to the Facebook page, Facebook.com/12enough, to find out about. I need to talk like a Canadian. If I talked more like a Canadian, I wouldn't stumble on my words, right? Is that one of the gifts that they have? Is that a Canadian ability to not stumble on words? So if you want to go to the Facebook page to find out about different things that are going on, different things that we are doing, or I'm doing, the 12 Enough team is doing. We have a team. We have t-shirts. We're in softball tournaments. Come to the webpage. Come to the webpage at 12enough.com, where you can find the show notes for this show and other shows, and read about the things I post on my blog and all that other kinds of things. You know, a lot of fun stuff. I'm all about fun. Fun, 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 fun. And as always, thank you very much for listening. Well Enough is a podcast about Christian faith and culture in the modern age. The thoughts, ideas, ruminations, opinions, moments of brilliance, moments of drudgery, thick-headedness, of ahas, and all other kinds of moments, all the moments on this podcast and everything else do not reflect Richard Wright or J.D. Salinger or the families thereof of each. They do not reflect their churches, their denominations, their friends, their families, the state of Massachusetts, of Rhode Island, of Attleboro, of East Greenwich, or anything else of that nature. These are their own ideas. This is their podcast.